From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and there are no more state primaries left in the presidential contest this year.
No applauding.
Right? Well, and especially because, yes, we know Washington, D.C. is voting next week, but yes, not technically a state, so my sentence is still correct. Hillary Clinton won the California primary, giving her victories in 4 of 6 contests yesterday. Last night, she spoke to her supporters in New York City.
Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee.
Still, Bernie Sanders is vowing to fight on to the convention, and the presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump sharpened his attacks on Clinton.
Our schools are failing. Crime is rising. People are scared. The last thing we need is Hillary Clinton in the White House or an extension of the Obama disaster.
Donald Trump also was spanked by his party leaders yesterday because of his language. And maybe in response, he gave his speech last night by teleprompter, very reined in. So where are we the day after? Well, joining us now, Here and Now, political analysts, Republican strategist Paris Denard. Hi, Paris.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. And Democratic strategist Angela Rye. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
And neither of you affiliated with any campaigns, but Angela, we have to start with you. Did the earth move for you? A female candidate wearing white, like Geraldine Ferraro did when she was Mondale's VP nod. What did this mean? Was this meaningful for you on that level?
So maybe not because she was wearing white, although Paris and I were talking about the psychology behind that a second ago, and I told him that I thought it was smart that white was the chosen color, particularly because of the numbers you can continue to see with Hillary Clinton and her trustworthiness and whether or not folks think she's honest.
So it's sort of an angelic choice. Yeah, an angelic.
Yeah, exactly. And then even like the arms, like they said, this is going to be the GIF that they use where her arms are up like, whoa. So I thought it was very, very smart. In terms of the earth moving for me, what I will tell you is I don't know that anything will ever feel like the moment when Barack Obama became the Democratic presidential nominee for me. But I will also tell you, I was on Twitter like, okay, she's about to cry. Okay, she's about to cry. And then I was like, well, now I'm crying because the reality of the moment setting in, her tying the 19th Amendment's ratification to the birth date of her mother, the fact that her mother wasn't there, the fact that she talked about her mother always urging her to stand up to a bully and she's facing one in November, the fact that she said that, you know, her mom had basically been there for every major milestone in her life and she wasn't there yesterday. It was a tear-jerking moment for me. I certainly could appreciate how important and significant it was to their family and for women everywhere to know that this really is a reality for us. We can be the president, and we can definitely be the nominee for parties.
Paris, as a Republican strategist, what did it mean to you? I mean, did it mean anything that it was an historic moment in that sense?
It reminded me of when Queen Elizabeth walks in her beautiful white regalia to be coronated.
Oh, Lord.
And so this was a coronation of sorts. You know what I thought about, Jeremy? I thought about all the years that the Clintons have been plotting and planning to make this work and the things that she's had to endure and suffer because of the actions of her husband. And now, after 30-some-odd years of planning, she finally got what she wanted. And what was particularly interesting to me was that her entire speech, in my opinion, was focused on herself, her narrative, her womanness, the historic moment for her as Hillary Clinton, as a woman, did not talk about the people, the other people, the American people.
What speech did you listen to?
The one last night that left me not so inspired or awestruck. I felt it was about her. And this is the same problem that Senator Rubio, no, she won't. It's the same issue that Senator Rubio had. The narrative has to be more than just your personal story. Ask me why she's running. Outside of the fact that it's a historic moment for women or for herself or for as an end note to her bio.
But
you can't answer that question.
That's not true, Paris.
But I was going to say, in that moment, you can't go that far outside the fact that it's an historical moment for women. I mean, it's a big
right.
deal moment. But
then why are a lot of women supporting her? She's having struggles. She's struggling with the woman vote.
Right.
And I think it's because they can look past it and say, okay, great. We have a woman who arguably is qualified. But what more has she done for
Paris,
women? And what more can she do for me right now?
Paris,
for jobs, the economy, for immigration.
But Paris, in the moment last night, you saw people who still are not supporting Hillary even tweeting on their social media saying that they recognize the historic nature of the moment. Right. What I can't understand about Republican trolls over the last 24 hours is why y'all can't see that this is still a historic
Paris,
moment, whether you're Republican
or Democrat. She's not calling
Democrat.
You a troll. That she didn't
yeah,
mean
yes,
that.
I am.
Okay.
I mean, she called me a troll.
Okay, I call him a troll.
But Angela, he makes a point. What do you do about the women? We're hearing analysts this morning saying she has to now get the women who are not in her,
yes.
her camp, maybe the Republicans, younger women who might have supported Sanders. We're hearing analysts say, who, for them, the fact that it's the first woman, that doesn't mean enough. But on the other yes. hand, we're hearing they also don't know her or her history. They are young, and so they may not know some of the baggage that that brings. So what does she do going forward? She can't, as Paris says, make it all about being the first woman.
No, she can't. And I think Paris is right. And I think that if he was paying attention to her campaign, he'd note that she has not been able to do that. And she therefore has not done that. Mm-hmm. To your point, Lynn, about what she has to do to bring in particularly young women voters is make it clear that it's not about the Clinton legacy of yesterday. It's about what she's going to do going forward as the first woman president going forward. She hit on some of that. I think it was very clear last night. She talked about tearing down barriers and not building up walls. She talked about taking on bullies. She talked about fighting for the little guy and having the back of the American people. Those are things that not only ring true to Hillary Clinton supporters, mm-hmm. but certainly to Bernie supporters. She made a very hard pitch to them last night, and I think it was clear. So she's definitely got work to do, but I don't want to discount what she
said. Well, what happens now with Bernie? Because is he gonna stay in this thing really all the way till the convention, even though she now has millions more votes than him? She'll have a majority of even the pledge delegates. I mean, Angela, Paris, take it away. But what do you think is going to happen with Bernie?
Bernie has a right to stay in this race. I think the millions
of course
of people
you
who,
would say that.
Right, but he's right. He does have a right.
But the millions of people who
he
support
don't have no
him
money.
And the energy that's behind it, he can go and have a floor fight. And this cause that he's been fighting has become bigger than I think he even thought it was going to be. And so
that's
now
true.
I believe he has a mandate and a responsibility to his people to do something with it, to bow out and to say, thanks, I give it over to Hillary Clinton, who stands for nothing that I stand for, is not going to be something that his
true.
People want.
Their
him
voting
to do.
Record is the 93% similar from when she was in the Senate. But Lynn, just really quick, the only point that I would raise.
I have to say, Angela, and I know you're just misspeaking because you're used to Lynn, our producer, who in fact is homesick
oh my God!
Today. That's all right.
I'm so
that's
sorry,
okay.
Robin.
It's okay. That's right. She's home listening.
Hi, Lynn.
Right. So continue.
Thank you. That was a good call. And you're absolutely right. I'm sorry about that.
No, don't worry about it.
Lynn and Robin. So the one thing that I would say to that is this isn't just about Bernie Sanders wanting to stay in. There's something that he needs to be there and mm-hmm. to remain here, and that's called resources, of which they're dwindling. He's cutting back on campaign staff. Yes, we've seen this once before, but he also has a meeting in the Oval tomorrow with Barack Obama, and right. I think that has everything to do with the fact that the race is wrapping up. The president has to endorse Hillary at this point, and Bernie Sanders is going to fall in line. He's got to say he's going to stay in the
But he also has leverage.
I think
he has leverage.
Oh, yeah, yes. and he yeah. will use his leverage, I think, yeah. to help shape the platform, but it won't be much more than that. He's not going to be the VP,
But will he get the superdelegate structure changed or get environmentalist Bill McKibben on the platform committee?
I don't know about either of those. Yeah. What I can tell you is that he's had some successes already in helping to shape the platform committee. And I think that as a result, he's going to help shape the platform. I think that if Bernie Sanders is going to continue to have the persuasion and the influence that he needs, he's going to have to bow out right after this D.C. race.
And, of course, Donald Trump is just in love with Bernie Sanders and his supporters. Listen to him last night in his teleprompter address. Here he is.
To all of those Bernie Sanders voters who have been left out in the cold by a rigged system of superdelegates, we welcome you with open arms.
Paris, I want to ask you about that. I mean, does mm-hmm. he really think he's going to get many of those? And by the way, there are a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who were trying to decide between Trump and Sanders. But also, is Trump in big trouble right now with a lot of Republicans backing away from him in a pretty public way? Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and others. I mean, maybe they're still saying they're endorsing him, but they're doing it in a kind of weird way.
Two things. One, it was a very smart move for Donald Trump to appeal to Bernie Sanders supporters, because when they have the choice of looking between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, they're not going to go flocking to Hillary Clinton because she's a Johnny-come-lately or Jane-come-lately when it comes to the progressive movement. And when they look at what Donald Trump stands for and the things that he talks about, a lot of people like Reagan Democrats are going to come over and become Trump. Democrats are going to come over for Donald Trump. And the other point is, with respect to Donald Trump and the Republican establishment on the Hill, look, they have to protect their own brands. I get it. This happens in politics. It's the nature of it. But at the end of the day, they're all good soldiers and they understand one thing, and that is, in order to win in November, you have to have a Republican in the White House, and that Republican is going to be Donald Trump. And Donald Trump also is going to appoint a cabinet, an entire administration, and Speaker Ryan knows this, and he said it repeatedly, that the person who can carry out his opportunity agenda and the positive things that he's doing as it relates to fighting poverty with the Better America is through Donald Trump supporting him. And he knows that Hillary Clinton is not on board with that agenda. And so they'll say this publicly because they have races to run and a brand to follow, but privately they're going to vote for Donald Trump.
Okay. Well, Paris, we have to wrap it up, but I just want to say I think the language, they will be all good soldiers, may not be the language the Republicans want going for. Republican strategist Paris Denard making an impassioned case there. And Angela Rye, Democratic strategist before that. We love you guys. Thank you
we
so
love
much.
Y'all.
Thank
and
you, Robin.
We'll continue to check in with you as the election
Thanks,
goes
Thanks, guys.
The Fresh Air Fund is one of life's great equalizers. Since 1877, it sent poor inner-city kids from New York to the country to live with host families. But it was actually conceived by the Reverend Willard Parsons in rural Sherman, Pennsylvania. Parsons asked his parishioners to take in poor New York kids. It soon grew so big, he asked for help from a New York City paper. Today, the assistance comes from the New York Times, and it sends kids to 13 states and Canada. It's a huge enterprise, with families welcoming the kids and staff needed to screen the families. Plus, the Fresh Air Fund has expanded to include job and college mentoring, and it has a new leader at the helm. In today's View from the Top, our conversations with leaders. Fatima Shama, Executive Director of the Fresh Air Fund, joins us. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And you say you could have been a Fresh Air kid.
Easily. I was born and raised in the Bronx, and my parents were immigrants to this country. I lived with public housing right up the street. Some of New York City's lowest performing schools were my zoned schools. And to be really honest, summer camp for me was going to our local public school for free breakfast and playing in the street, and then going back to the school for free lunch, and then going to our local public library for the afternoon.
Yeah, and maybe opening a fire hydrant when they got
super hot. I almost said that, but yeah, you said it for me. Exactly.
Well, there you go. But so that brings our first question. Yes, this tremendous organization sends, you know, 4,000 kids in the summer to those 13 states we mentioned in Canada, another 3,000 to the five Fresh Air camps up in Fishkill, New York, and upstate. But how do you decide? Because for every 1,000 kids you send, 3,000 or 4,000 don't go. You know, it's how do you make those decisions?
Yeah. Yeah. So in New York City, there are nearly 2 million kids who would be eligible based on age range, and a third of whom live in poverty. So we estimate about 600,000 kids in New York City live in poverty. And we at the Fresh Air Fund aim to recruit those children. One of the things we try to do are find children who would be eligible for free lunch, as evident, to participate in the program. And we get 11,000 applications annually for what you've just identified as 7,000 seats. And at this point, it is first come, first serve, but we are quite cognizant of the need. One of the things we aim to do are find more families who would be willing to host more children, because that is something we can continue to grow. And it is astounding to me because, as you noted, our history is actually started 140 years ago. We celebrate that this summer. And the Reverend Parsons actually started this, I have to just say, my background is in health and education policy. This was a public health solution. Children in New York City's Lower East Side tenements were living with tuberculosis, and it was spreading because of the fact that kids had no access to cleansing their lungs.
Fresh air. They needed fresh air.
Precisely. And today, the fact is that we don't have tuberculosis, but we have asthma, and we have communities riddled with crime and gun violence, and we have obesity and a lack of open space for kids to actually just play and be kids. So still, the Fresh Air Fund is as relevant as it was 140 years ago, and we need families who would continue to welcome children from our low-income communities into their neighborhoods and communities.
You make so many great points here that this isn't just, oh, wouldn't it be nice for a kid to see a piece of clover, which in fact it would be,
right.
But that it's a, that right. it is a health issue. And I just want to note that in the 1800s, the immigrants helped were predominantly Irish and Italian.
That's right.
I'm just curious. You know, the immigrant population keeps changing every 100 years or so.
That's right.
And the Irish and the Italian, we have to constantly remind ourselves, we're as vilified, you know, as immigrants are today.
Mm-hmm.
But do you see there, is there, when you keep saying we need host families, is there any, is it more difficult to place children of color, which are predominantly the children being considered today?
I have to tell you, I think that I have had the pleasure of visiting families within the many states that host our kids. And I think people come to this who are interested in opening up their hearts and their homes to help children less fortunate than themselves. The truth is that the immigrants of yesterday are not the same as today. And so what once was Irish and German and Italian immigrants today are Chinese and Mexican and children from West Africa and a large population of American-born, African-American children. But I have yet to find so many families that would say to me, well, those weren't the kids we were hoping to help.
Yeah.
Part of it is our making sure we tell that story. That immigration is dynamic and new immigrants today look differently than ones 30, 40, hundreds of years ago. But that is what makes actually the New York story and American story, in my opinion, so rich, is that it is this dynamic experience that in every, as you noted, every decade or two or three changes.
What are your challenges? Because you do have challenges finding the host families. Why?
I think the reality is once upon a time, families had summers that were more relaxed, perhaps. There were more moms who were home. Now we have many homes that two parents are working. Mm-hmm. And so 2-week summer vacations are sort of their reality and their ability to not only have their own downtime as a family, but also invite someone to be a part of that might be more complicated. We do go through a pretty rigorous background check process, an interview process to make sure that a home is a child. One of the homes that has volunteered to do this is a home where you and I would send our children. And so it's an interview. It's a home visit. It's a background check process. It's reviewing and speaking to 4 different references. So it's fairly rigorous. And some folks may or may not be up for that deep of a challenge. But for those that go through it, and we have 4,000 of whom who do, we're really delighted that they've done that work. And we certainly know that as our applications continue to come into our office, we can easily send more children to homes who would be willing to go through that process.
Well, then there's the fact that camp, or for many of these kids, it was not even camp. It's just to go get somewhere where there's fresh air. Mm. But for thousands, it's the camps up in upstate New York. I urge people, I mean, if you get the New York Times, you read the stories about the fresh air fund and how much the kids are getting out of it. But in camps in general across the country, it's become this competitive business, super expensive camps where kids go to study computers and some camps focused on getting into college. How do you compete with that without losing that original mission of we just want to make sure kids have fun where there's grass?
You know, I have to say, I mean, I don't think we compete with it, largely because I think we're giving opportunity for children who would likely never have the opportunity. And I think that's both what we pride ourselves on, but it's also what makes us uniquely special and special for the families we're trying to both recruit and serve. So what absolutely happens at camp is fun. But it is fun that I will define as layered with enrichment. And so for many of our children, they've never seen lakes before. And the idea of swimming in one is a whole new experience. Swimming, actually, as I've learned from many of our children and our families, is something that is quite unique for our kids. Most of them don't know how to swim. And in their 2 weeks with us, they go through this rigorous process. But the idea that while they're learning how to swim, they're in this water where they're learning that beneath their feet is an actual living ecosystem. And we talk about the pHs of water and the differences between pools and lake and actually what could be more natural. And amid that, they're actually learning or hearing sounds of birds around them. And so someone is teaching them what those birds could be. And so embedded in all of this learning that is true fun are all these new vocabulary words or all these scientific terms that become real because back in the classroom, they're going to get introduced in some way, shape, or form in the life sciences or in a science class. And what actually is quite real to be, to sort of put on a little bit of an ed policy hat is, this is what differentiates so many middle-income children to low-income children. Kids have these experiences that, as you know, parents pay for. In low-income families, our children don't necessarily have these and therefore may differentiate them from being able to have the vocabulary or experiences that they can then write about, right? Someone learning how to swim is a story in their writing class. And it's these experiences that truly are still fun, but really are allowing enrichment to happen in a different way.
So Fatima Sharma, again, executive director for the Fresh Air Fund, you've talked about needing to recruit kids. You've said that when you were a kid, again, the daughter of a Palestinian and a Brazilian, they met in Brazil, and your parents, who are immigrants, didn't know about the fund. So you're trying to get through to these immigrant communities today. You're trying to find more families at a time when they're, you know, not all families are home over the summer to host kids at their home as opposed to the camps. But also just, you know, money. Obviously, this terrific relationship with the New York Times. But what is your biggest financial challenge?
Well, we have an annual operating budget of nearly $17 million. And to send 7,000 children to experiences, to keep up the infrastructure at our camps, to continue to grow our work and to ensure and minimize risks to all of our children, these are very expensive things. So we raise 75% of our money from individual donors. And we need to always ensure that we're maintaining those relationships and grooming them and growing them. Not different from any nonprofit, but for us, it really is about children and being able to serve them at this intersection of both what is a summer experience, but really a summer experience, as we've talked about, that can start changing a child's life.
Fatima Sharma, executive director of the Fresh Air Fund, the nonprofit that brings summer experiences to lower income kids from New York. Fatima, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And just in case you just got interested, we'll link you up at hereandnow.org. And let's check in Michigan after five people were killed, four injured, when a pickup plowed into a group of cyclists in Cooper Township just outside Kalamazoo yesterday. Police had received calls about a man driving erratically but couldn't get there in time. Tom Hillen of Wood TV 8 in Grand Rapids is here. And Tom, it seems these were just cyclists, nothing out of the ordinary.
No, and that's what we've heard, that this was a group of people that would often ride together, likely in this area. We've heard from people that they've seen them out there before, so it's not like it was a foreign place for them to be riding. They know the road. They seem to be experienced bicyclists, and then just out of nowhere, you have this person who is allegedly driving erratically and just plows right into them.
Now, I understand the person's name hasn't been released, but they are in custody?
That is correct. Police were able to secure the suspect after the crash. He did jump out of his truck and took off running, police say, and they were able to take him into custody. So far, no name being released. What we do know about him is that he's a 50-year-old man from the West Michigan area, but the prosecutor saying that he is not releasing the suspect's name until he's able to formally charge him, which he doesn't expect to be able to do until tomorrow.
Well, there were people in the area. There's a fisherman quoted by the AP who said he almost got hit but couldn't warn the cyclists. I mean, is there any question as to whether or not the cyclists were maybe jutting out into the road or...
From what we can tell, that the cyclists were not doing anything that they were not supposed to be doing, that they were following the rules of the road. There's not been any accounts to say that they were acting irresponsibly, and all indications are the driver was just driving erratically. Police departments from three different agencies received phone calls starting at 6:08 that night, all different accounts reporting the same driver driving erratically, and then this crash happened right about 6:35.
The people who made those calls and the police who received them must be sick about this. You know, they tried.
Absolutely. They were out looking for this person, just could not get to them before this terribly tragic event unfolded.
Yeah. Well, just a terrible thing. And in an area that recently had another spasm of just random, out-of-nowhere violence with the Uber driver who was picking up riders and shooting people.
Yeah, this has been an area that has unfortunately been rocked by tragedy just a few months ago. It was only February where six random people just going about their daily lives were gunned down by this man. So those are still very fresh wounds in this community. And then to experience this just a few months later, again, a senseless act, it seems. There's no real indication right now what was going on with that driver that caused this crash. So it's very difficult and it's very tragic for this community to have to experience something like this all over again in such a short time.
And again, we'll wait to hear what the charges are. I mean, it could have been a health episode. We don't know. Do cyclists plan any kind of, you know, public reaction to this?
Yes, we do know that there have already been things placed at the scene of the crash. There's a park nearby where this crash was, and that seems to be where people plan to gather tonight to memorialize these five people that tragically lost their lives.
Tom Hillen of Wood TV in the Kalamazoo, Michigan area, where five cyclists were killed by a man reportedly driving a truck erratically. Just terrible. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I just got back from California, and while I was there, we recorded a special edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Ann Litt and Travis Holcomb from KCRW in Santa Monica are here with me in the studio. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Great to be here.
And we've got this special edition because we've got double the fun. You've both brought some of your selections, a lot of L.A. favorites here. And let's start with you. You wanted us to hear something from the L.A. group Mondo Cosmo. This is Hold On To Me. On Twitter, this group describes itself as music out of a guest bedroom in East Los Angeles. Anne, what turned you onto this?
Well, apparently they are music out of a guest bedroom in East Los Angeles. That's actually true. I think this song, when I heard it, it was so full of longing and yearning, but somehow affirming at the same time. It's a little messy, and the vocals aren't perfect, but when you hear him just saying, hold on to me, hold on to me, this is one of those songs that just sort of grabbed my heart and twisted it in half.
So. And tell us more about Mondo Cosmo.
Well, Mondo Cosmo is actually a guy who was in a band called Eastern Conference Champions a while back. They broke up, and now he's doing some solo work. That's actually his wife singing backup, and he's just done a video for this song, which actually stars his good friend, the actress Anna Faris, which you gotta check out. In fact, your people should post this up on the website.
We will do that at hereandnow.org. And Travis, since this is a battle of the DJs, let's get to one of your picks. This is the group called The Avalanches. It's called Frankie Sinatra featuring Danny Brown and MF Doom.
Frank Sinatra, Frankie, me boy, you don't know. You have a goofy voice to sing calypso. What did they say? Frankie, me boy, you don't know. You have a goofy voice to sing calypso.
Office rocker, he's office rocker. Please, Mr. Officer, I only had some vodka. Let him just a few. Only reaping struggle while I'm here while I'm driving. Player registration, OG license. Cause of that interior, you just wanna ride.
It's sounds like it's music with a sense of humor, Travis.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like the sample sources that the Avalanches use, and pretty much most of their music is built off of samples. They always find something really left field. It's never the typical sample sources like James Brown or P-Funk. And in this case, they're taking from this Calypso song from the 50s by Wilmuth Houdini. Hmm. The song itself doesn't really seem to have anything to do with Frank Sinatra, despite the title. but, you know, it still works.
And this is their first album, this group, The Avalanches, this is their first album in 15 years.
Yeah, this is the first thing we've heard since their last album was released in 2001. So, I mean, in terms of all of the big comebacks, I feel like that are happening in the last couple of years, this is probably the one I'm looking forward to the most.
And you're nodding your head.
I agree wholeheartedly. And hearing this song for the first time was like, they're back.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to another one from you, Anne. This is the LA electronic group Kauf. This is called Through the Yard. So now you have put me back in the place where this is where I really fell in love with KCRW, when I was getting up in the middle of the night to host the Marketplace Morning Report and listening. This is back when Travis, before he got his promotion and became part of the evening rotation, he was on in the middle of the night. I used to listen to him as I was waking up. But this is, it's such an LA sound.
It really is. And I think it's those dreamy electronics, but it's the foundation of it is definitely in world beats and a sound that's very natural. There are flutes in there, it sounds like to me. And then on top of that, it becomes this sort of swirling electronic, kind of sunny, shimmery sound.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like a live electronic hybrid thing that I feel like is going on a lot with groups like Bob Moses, and there's a bunch of groups like that here.
And
in
I saw him perform on Friday night here in Los Angeles, and it definitely retained that in the live performance. I really enjoyed watching him perform.
All right, well, Travis, let's go back to you. This is Justin Jay and Friends. It's called Let Go, featuring Josh Taylor. People across the country are dancing in their cars now, Travis. Tell us about this one.
Well, Justin Jay is another LA-based artist. It's sort of like a live electronic hybrid again. But I kind of first came on to him with his house music productions that he's been doing for about 5 years. But in the last year or so, he's been putting out records under the name Justin Jay and Friends. And it's been kind of like, you know, breezy, soft, rockish disco pop like this. It's a nice progression for him.
And on the Facebook page, listing of influences, you will find both Daft Punk and Rachmaninoff.
Okay, there you go.
Fun fact.
I don't hear
Justin
too much Rachmaninoff, but I'll take his word for it.
But I like the sunny summer thing going on here.
Absolutely. Well, we have one more that you both wanted us to hear. This is by Beck. It's called Wow. Okay, so I want to ask each of you why you like this one so much.
I love the bass on it. I mean, like, to me, one of the through lines through Beck's career, mostly aside from when he does the sad folky stuff, has always been hip hop. And this is probably the most overtly hip hop song he's done in, since Odelay, probably. And that's one of the things I love about it.
And?
Well, I love that you reference his sad, folky stuff. I love that he's not taking himself too seriously. It's lighthearted Beck. It's not serious, worried Beck. It's lighthearted Beck. And he sounds like he's having a ball.
This place is really the home of entertainment around the world. But really, we're talking there largely about film and television. What about music, though? Also a very important part of this place.
Well, I think the scene, the music scene in Los Angeles has been, in the time I've been here, growing and maturing. And I feel the energy of that. And it's getting me really excited these days about what's happening in music, honestly, more than in film and television.
Travis?
And I also feel like just because rent here is still, you could still find a pretty cheap
apartment.
You can
live cheaply if you want
to. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of artists from San Francisco and New York are starting to migrate here to Los Angeles. And it's a very collaborative city. I mean, you know, it's hard to get around. You have to, if you live on a different side of town, you have to really plan carefully when you're going to go to the other side of town. But I feel like the artists that are coming here are looking to collaborate with other people that whose work that they admire. And I feel like you can hear that in the sort of melding of sounds that we have here in Los Angeles.
Completely agree with that.
And lucky for us, we have both of you to find all the music and bring it to us. Travis Holcomb and Ann Litt of KCRW. Thanks so much. Great to see you both.
Good to see you too. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And we've got all of our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's just on Spotify. Search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
More than 29 million Americans have diabetes, according to the American Diabetes Association, and more than 1.4 million new cases are diagnosed every year. Most of those people have to use insulin pumps or needles, lots of needles, needles that make it possible to keep blood sugar levels in check with shots of insulin, but needles that are also uncomfortable, painful. A Missouri researcher may have found a way to ease the life-saving ordeal with light. Alex Smith from Here and Now contributor KCUR and the Heartland Health Monitor reports.
On a busy league night in Raytown, a suburb of Kansas City, retired auto worker Raymond Fowler keeps his game up playing alongside his wife and longtime teammates.
This is my exercise in the evening time.
Fowler, who's 67, is staying busy in his retirement, but it's not all fun. A few years ago, he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and made a lot of changes to his exercise routine and diet. His condition was severe enough that his doctor said he needed insulin shots. That's one change he had trouble making.
The insulin, it would burn when you chewed yourself. It would just sting. And so after a while, I went back and talked to my endocrinologist and told her, I can't keep doing this the rest of my life.
Insulin is a protein, so it can't be taken orally with a pill because the body would try to digest it. Instead, many diabetics have to inject it with a syringe or a pen. The routine can be especially complicated for type 1 diabetics who have to test glucose levels and adjust insulin levels many times a day. In his lab at the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Pharmacy, Professor Simon Friedman is working to change how insulin injections work. It's not an area he originally set out to work in.
We were interested in light, actually. It started off with light, and we had quite a few years of developing methods to use light to control other biological processes.
Friedman recently got a grant of nearly $1.5 million from the National Institutes of Health to develop his alternate insulin delivery system. His idea is to create a single injection that would contain lots of individual insulin doses held together in a resin using special molecular bonds that are especially sensitive to light.
They're molecules that do chemistry when you shine light on them. So they're kind of related to the molecules you might find in a recordable CD or a recordable DVD. They undergo photochemistry. Chemistry bonds being made and broken using light.
Light-sensitive bonds have been used in fields like genetics for a few years, but they're new to pharmaceuticals. Here's what Friedman has in mind. A patient would inject the mixture right under the skin and strap an LED light on top of it. This would work in conjunction with a constant glucose monitoring system to determine when the body needs insulin. When that happens, the light would shine through the skin and break the link between the resin and the insulin, and this would free the drug to enter the bloodstream. Unlike injections spread out over the course of a day, this approach would adjust insulin levels constantly.
That's the nice thing about light control is you can continuously vary light by, you know, second by second. You can change the intensity of a light. You can change the duration of a light that's exposed. And with that, you can get continuously variable changes in release.
Friedman hopes the method will cut required injections down to once every few days, once a week, or possibly every few weeks. The new insulin system is promising, says Marc Perreault, a sociology professor who studies quality of life issues for diabetics at Loyola University, Maryland in Baltimore.
We have to think about the human side. How can we make it easy for patients to be able to use the medication and medication systems?
But he says that to get patients on board with the new technology, it has to be simple and streamlined, unlike, say, insulin pumps and inhalable insulin, which haven't really taken off.
Anytime you ask a patient to change from what they're already doing to something else, there's barriers. There's just inertia there. Learning something new, learning about a new device, finding out about it creates a barrier.
But Perreault also sees a couple of wrinkles that may need working out. Constant glucose monitoring isn't quite perfected yet, but even if it is, it would probably have to be worn, along with the light emitter itself, on the outside of the body. And for some, this could be a deal breaker.
Patients also sometimes have concerns that have to do more with, say, cosmetics, things like being concerned what they will look like if they have a device attached to their body.
Whatever form it takes, insulin without regular injections can't come soon enough, as far as Raymond Fowler is concerned. Exercise, diet, and oral medications have allowed him to stop taking insulin, but his blood sugar is creeping up again, and he's now facing the possibility of having to start injections all over. He confesses he's been putting off some doctor's visits.
And that was the reason why at first I didn't want to go back to see her, because I knew she put me back on insulin, and I just couldn't fool with the needles no more.
Professor Friedman says he'll likely need several more years to perfect the insulin and light technology before it's ready for public use. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Smith.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to Here and Now.